Good evening, and this is the class that I've been dreading. Out of all the classes today, this is the hardest one, certainly for me. I've taught about the life of Ataliah a couple of times over the years, but it's been about 6 or 7 years since the last time that I did it, and the reason is because this is a hard story. Not hard emotionally, not hard in terms of how can you wrap your mind around it. It's actually, you know, on the straightforward side in that sense. But genealogy, names, the whole story is really, really hard to work with. So bear with me as we learn about Ataliah the Killer Queen. Once again, grateful to Yeshivat Or Chaim for enabling us to have this program in our home Beit Midrash, to Shaar Shamayim for providing the copies of the Tanakh that we have. This class is dedicated in appreciation of the YU Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash by the Reines family. Thank you, Reineses. Okay. So, our story actually begins in the class that you just had, the class about Ahav and Izebel. For those who have a Tanakh in front of them, page 867, or I should say 869, is where the story begins. But if you're looking at the sheet, you'll see I did the best I could to try to make this clear by providing a cast of characters. So we have three different generations who are going to be involved here. Ahav and Izebel you just heard about. Ahav being the king of the northern kingdom of Yisrael. This story takes place about 100 years, maybe a little later, into the first Beit HaMikdash, depending on your chronology, which one you use, maybe about the 9th century before the Common Era, maybe a little bit later. But this story starts with that first generation, and specifically the curse against the house of Ahav. So taking a look on page 869 in your Tanakh, we're looking at chapter 21 of Malachim Aleph. We are looking at sentences 20 to 22, where Ahav says to Eliyahu, "Hamitzaasni oivi, v'yomer matzasi." He says, "Have you found me, my enemy?" And Eliyahu says, "You bet, I have found you." And as they add in the brackets, "I have found you guilty." Yanis makirchol asos hara b'nei Hashem. You sold yourself to do that which is evil in the eyes of God. Hineni mevi elecha ra'a. I am bringing evil upon your household. Ubi'arti acharecha. And I am going to destroy. I like the English here. Annihilate. That's such a better word. I don't know if they do that consistently when the word Leva'er shows up in Tanakh. They should. I'm going to annihilate everything after you. Everything is going to be eliminated from your household. Your household will be like Yerubim ben Nevat's household, like Basha ben Achiah. You're going to be destroyed. Your household is gone. And that's going to play out in the life of Ataliah. But a key question that I want to address here is, how do we view Ataliah? Take a look on source number 2, please, on your sheet. This one comes from a book called Reading the Women of the Bible. My quote of this passage is not an endorsement of the book per se. I haven't read the whole book. But this is from the preface, in which she says something that I found very interesting. She writes, "The stories then," she's talking about stories in Tanakh, "were not written in order to make statements about women. I have identified 4 categories of stories, 4 discourses to which these stories address themselves. With my fondness for alliteration, I label these woman as victor, woman as victim, woman as virgin bride-to-be, and woman as voice of God." So what she's saying is, if you look through the stories in Tanakh that feature women, they should fit into one of these 4 roles. And the question that I have is, where does Ataliah fit? Is she victor? Certainly fits. Or is she victim? And we're going to see an argument each way as we learn her story. So again, our story starts with Ahav and Izebel. This is a period of time in which Yisrael, the northern kingdom, is tending towards idolatry, specifically Baal, the Canaanite god, Asherah, another type of worship. In the south, under King Asa, there's an attempt to wean the Jews from idolatry. Doesn't exactly work. Ahab and Jezebel devote themselves to one task, really, which is rolling back the clock. The goal of Ahab and Jezebel is to turn Israel into Canaan. So they rebuild the city of Jericho, which was the first city that we attacked when we entered into the land that had been Canaan, to turn it into Israel. They kill the prophets of God and want to set up the prophets of the Baal. They want this to turn into Canaan 2.0. And as we read, there is a curse on the house of Ahab and Jezebel. Without going through that whole story again, that was what Rabbi Heft just addressed. Ahab is killed, and then you get to the rise of Ataliah. So Ataliah is a daughter, it seems, of Ahab and Jezebel. If you go to Kings 2, chapter 8, you'll see what I mean. You want page 897. Okay, Kings 2, chapter 8, sentences 16 to 18 is what we're looking at. So it's towards the bottom of the page. The fifth year of Joram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, we have not discussed them yet. We haven't gone there at this point. Jehoram ben Jehoshaphat becomes the king of Judea. He is 32 years old when he takes the throne. He reigns for 8 years in Yerushalayim. That's not the part yet that I am looking for. I am looking for the parts that was what I had actually wanted there. It may take me a moment. Okay, I don't know why I gave the reference to those psukim, because those are not the ones that I want. What I did want, and I'm going to see if I can find it quickly, otherwise I will just say it outside, was the reference to Ataliah here as the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. And I thought that I had it here, but I am apparently mistaken. In this section, we do find the reference to her as the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. She is also listed separately as the daughter of Omri, who is Ahab's father. So there's a lot of work that's been done on this. I brought you a reference in source number 5 to a paper online where somebody goes through this in great depth, trying to figure out whose sister and whose daughter she is. It's not relevant for our shiur. I'm going to go with the assumption that she is the daughter, in fact, of Ahab and Jezebel, which means that she is already marked for death because she is part of that household that has been cursed. Well, she gets married. And this is here in Malachim Bet, chapter 8, sentence 24. I believe. Yes. She is going to get married to Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, who is the king of Yehuda. So now imagine this in your head. She is the daughter of the king of Yisrael, Ahab in the north. And she is marrying Jehoram ben Jehoshaphat, king of Yehuda, of Judea. This is a political marriage. This is not, they met at the bowling alley, and they fell for each other, and afterwards he called her, and no. This is a political marriage. It is an attempt to bond the two kingdoms, to expand their economic cooperation, to expand their military cooperation. However, the war that they fight together does not go well. And her brother, Joram ben Ahab, who is the king of Israel, is wounded in the battle. Her husband, Jehoram ben Jehoshaphat, who is the king in Yehuda, dies. So now, again, she is the daughter of Ahab in the north. Her brother is the new king after Ahab dies. Her brother is the king in the north. Her husband is the king in the south. Her brother, who is the king in the north, this is why I said this is the hardest one. Her brother, who is the king in the north, is wounded in battle. Her husband dies. So now, her son, Ahaziah, becomes the king in Yehuda in the south. And he is just like the family that she comes from. So her son is just like his good old grandfather, Ahab. Which is to say, he follows the path of idolatry. So now, her brother is the wounded king in the north. Her son is the new king in the south. Are we somewhat clear on this? I realize that it's confusing, but I hope this will help. What I didn't even go into, I keep mentioning the relationships instead of the names because I'm trying to avoid mentioning the names. The reason why I want to avoid mentioning the names is because at one point you have a king in the north named Yoram and a king in the south named Yehoram. And that just adds to the confusion. So I figure if I just keep saying brother, husband, son, like, we'll be better off. So, what we have now then again is Atalia's brother is the king in the north, her son is the king in the south. That brings us to Kings 2, chapter 9. Her brother, the king in the north, is recovering from his wounds received in battle. Elisha the prophet anoints a man by the name of Yehu and says, Yehu, you're going to be the new king in Yisrael, in the north. There already is a king. Don't worry about it. You are going to be the new king in the north, Yehu, and your mission is to wipe out the house of Ahav. So look at this story now. Chapter 9, sentence 14, the top of page 901. Look at what happens here. What a mess.
A royal mess.
Yes. Sentence 14. Just looking at it, read it straight through in the English. It's okay. Yehu, son of Yehoshaphat, son of Nimshi, organizes against Yehoram. Yehoram was the sitting king. And you see in parentheses, they give it to you in parentheses, which is interesting, that he is convalescing from his wounds in that war. We know about it already. So Yehu said, okay, let no refugee leave the city and go tell the news in Yisrael. So Yehu rides, and he goes to Yisrael, where Yehoram is recovering from his wounds. Ahaziah, the southern king, the son of Ataliah, is in for a visit. So he has the king of Yisrael and the king of Yehuda together at his mercy. There's a guard standing there. He sees Yehu's group approaching, and he says, there's a group of people approaching. And Yehoram, the king, the wounded king, says, send out a rider to see them. Let's see, does he come in peace? So the rider comes out and says, hey, are you here in peace? And Yehu says to him, what do you care whether I'm here for peace or not? Why don't you join me? And the guard comes back with a message saying that the rider hasn't come back. So they send a second rider to ask, do you come in peace? And Yehu gets him to join him as well. And so the watchman says, you know, the second guy didn't come back either. However, the driver, that's Yehu, and he's driving recklessly. So Yehoram says, I better get in my chariot. He gets into his chariot. We're in sentence 21. And now the king of Israel and the king of Yehuda set out to meet Yehu. And they see him and they say, do you come in peace? And the answer is, No way. No peace here. And Yehoram turns around and he says, it is a trick, Ahaziah. And Yehu draws his bow and he shoots Yehoram. We're now in sentence 25. And as you see it play out, as you work your way down the page, you see the rampage from Yehu. He kills the recuperating king of the northern kingdom, and he kills Ahaziah, who is the king of the southern kingdom, and then for good measure, at the end of the chapter, he kills Jezebel. But he's not done. That brings us to chapter 10. Because look at this. And the story is told also in Divrei Hayamim. In Divrei Hayamim, it's a lot more brief. Here, you get quite a bit of detail. And you look at chapter 10, and you find out that Yehu wipes out the family of Ahav and Jezebel in the north. And then in sentences 12 to 14, he goes south. So now we're already on page 905. We are flying through the pages. We haven't even gotten to what Ataliah is going to do yet. So at that point, Yehu goes down south. He meets relatives of Ahaziah, and he says, capture them alive. And then he slaughters 42 men. He wipes out the family of Ahaziah to the extent he can as well. And then he goes after the worshippers of the Baal. But he plays a trick. He says, let's have a big Baal party. Let's get everybody together. All of the worshippers of the Baal all have to come assemble together, and we're going to make a big celebration with big offerings. And he posts his men outside the gathering, and he says, none of them escape. And then he slaughters everybody inside. completely eliminates all these worshippers of the Baal. You can see it there. You can read the story as it plays out down the page. However, Yehu is not some, you know, zealous servant of God. He worships idols himself, and he leads the Jews after him, leading them astray. So what we now have, right, that was the hardest part. So 15 minutes of difficulty and then 15 minutes that are easier to follow. But what we have is Achav, the king of the north, Achav and Izebel, have a curse on their household. Their daughter Atalia is politically connected. Her brother's the king up north. Her son is the king down south. Both of them are destroyed by Yehu, who has been anointed by Elisha as the new king in the north. Yehu also goes on the rampage against the Baal. And now we get to Atalia and what she does when her son Ahaziah is killed by Yehu. We're at chapter 11, sentence 1, page 907 in the Stone Tanakh. Atalia, the mother of Ahaziah, sees that her son is dead. What does she do? She does not run away. Instead, Vatakam Vateabed is called Zeraha Mamlacha. She wipes out the rest of the family. When we say the rest of the family, to be clear, that's her kids. That's what we're talking about. She wipes out the rest of the family instead, but she doesn't quite succeed. Instead, Vatikach Yehosheva Bas HaMelech Yoram Achos Achaziyahu Es Yoash Ben Achaziyah. Yehosheva is the woman who saves the day. She is the daughter of Yoram. She saves her one-year-old brother, whose name is written sometimes as Yoash, sometimes as Yehoash. He's also the grandson, therefore, of Atalia. His father is Achaziyah, his mother is Tzivya. Yehosheva saves Yoash. But he's only a year old at this point, and she hides him away. That's sentence 2. Vayi ita beis Hashem. He hides with her. Mitchabe sheish shanim. He hides in the house of God for 6 years. Va'atalia molechet al haaretz. And Atalia is the queen for 6 years. Now, that's really interesting, because I didn't know we had queens. Right? A few hours ago, we talked about Devorah as the shofate, and that was surprising enough. Lo and behold, you have a queen. It is unusual. She is the only queen found, as far as I know, in Bayis Rishon, in the First Temple period. And it isn't just us. People in general did not have queens back in the day. Source number 6, Henny Marsman's work, Women in Ugarit in Israel. Of many queen mothers, we know virtually nothing. A small number of them are famous because they rose to a position of power. Mesopotamian queen mother Sammuramat ruled as regent for her son. In Egypt, several queen mothers ruled as regents for their minor sons. 4 out of 200 to 300 pharaohs were females, and there are names I can't pronounce. Only if a queen ruled in her own right did she not depend on her husband's power base, which was very exceptional. It was unusual in general to have a woman who would be running the country back in the day. It's also worth noting that when we get to the story of Atalia here, it doesn't use the standard boilerplate that it uses in general to describe kings. Meaning, there's a certain way that the Book of Kings describes kings. And it was in the year of so-and-so who was the king in the other kingdom, because you have Judah and Israel. So let's say we're describing the rise of a king in Judea. It will say, it was in the year of so-and-so, the king in the north, that so-and-so became the king in the south. And his father was so-and-so. He was good or he was bad. He reigned for this number of years, and then he died. And then we make it some story along with it. But that's your formula. You don't get that formula with Atalia. It makes it seem like she's not really the queen. At the same time, the text actually used the royal verb. Right? If you look carefully, it said it was in sentence 3, Molechet al haaretz. Malchut. She was the queen. And the people treat her as the queen. There's a lot of discussion in Halacha about her status, and the suggestion is that popular acclaim makes her a queen. Even though there is precedent for saying that the king is a male and the leader of the country is a male, nonetheless, popular acclaim renders her a legitimate queen, so much so that when she's done, The next one to lead is going to be Yehoash, her grandson, and he is going to require a ritual anointing, which should not be required if he just inherited the throne. So that suggests that, in fact, she was a legitimate queen. Either way, she certainly is ruling over the country for a period of 6 years. And then you get her downfall. Sentence four. Ubashana Shvi'it, year seven, Yehoyada the Kohen Gadol says, I think the time is ripe. And so he brings out the son of the old king. He brings out, in other words, Yehoash, and he says that everybody should keep watch. You can see the story here. He sets up different groups. Ultimately, the goal is to protect Yehoash, this young, new king. They do what Yehoyada, the Kohen Gadol, tells them to do. And then, as you go down the page, towards the bottom of the page, the last line there, sentence 12, Yehoyada brings out Yehoash, puts the crown on him, and the pages joined here gives him the crown, gives him the edut, which is understood to be the Torah that the king is supposed to have, coronates him as king, anoints him with oil, as we mentioned. Everybody claps and they say, Yechi HaMelech, long live the king. Atalia finds out, she hears what the nation is saying, and she sees that she didn't succeed, that Yehoash is in fact alive. She tears her clothing and she cries out, Kesher, Kesher, it's a plot, it's a plot. And Yehoyada commands the officers that he have, they come after her, and she is killed. And that's pretty much the end of her career. The people are happy, Yehoash is good, and he starts a campaign to refurbish and rededicate the Beis HaMikdash. That's your basic story of Atalia. What do we know about her besides that she killed out her family? Which, you know, is something to know about somebody in general. It is. It should go on the resume. But what else do we know about Atalia? So I gave you references in source number 8 to two important passages. Both from Divrei HaYamim Bet, the version of the story that appears in Chronicles 2. Chapter 22, sentence 3. It's page 1983. They would have taught this story to us in grade school. I would have been much more into Tanakh. It's a terrible story. I shouldn't make jokes, but yeah. Chapter 22, sentence 3. When you see the story there, you're told about Ahaziah, the son of Atalia. And look at this statement here. He followed the way of the house of Ahav, right? We said that before. But what we didn't say before is what's brought in the end of the sentence. Ki imo haisa yo'atzo l'harshia, his mother counseled him to be wicked. She trained Ahaziah to be like the house of Ahav. That's one. Second, in chapter 24, sentence 7, it's talking about how Yehoash sees a need to refurbish the Beis HaMikdash, to refurbish the temple. Why was there a need? So we find out in sentence 7 why there was a need. Because Ataliyahu HaMirshat, wicked Atalia, her sons broke into the house of God and they took the vessels from the sanctuary for Baal. Now mind you, that's not necessarily her. It's her sons. But then why was she mentioned? The fact that you mention her suggests, just like she was an influence on Ahaziah, one son of hers, she's an influence on the sons in general. So what we have here is an image of wickedness that isn't just she killed out the family as though that wasn't enough, but also that she leads her son astray and leads many of her sons astray to take the vessels of the temple for the Baal. So let's ask the question now. What motivated Atalia to wipe out her family? Why did she do it? When she gets word that her son Ahaziah is dead, right? Her brother's been killed up north, and her son, the king down south, is also dead. She wipes out the rest of the family, or tries to. Why? What's she trying to do? power. So one way to do it is to say she's opportunistic. That's the Josephus approach. Source number 9. Now when Ataliah, the daughter of Achav, heard the death of her brother Yoram and her son Ahaziah and the royal family, she endeavored that none of the house of David might be left alive, but that the whole family might be exterminated, that no king might arise out of it afterwards. I'm taking my ball and going home. Nobody else gets to be king. I'm in charge now, and I'm going to wipe out everybody else. That's one way. Another way to look at it is that it's out of fear. It's a matter of survival. Meaning, here she is abandoned in Judea. She was from the royal house in the north, which is now gone. She is now living down south. Her son was the king of Yehuda. He's just been killed. Who does she have who she can rely on? And she is going to go on a campaign to wipe everybody out, lest anybody come after her. That's another approach. Tikvah Frimer-Kensky, who I quoted before in the beginning about the roles of women in Tanakh, has a third possibility, which I find intriguing. I brought it for you in source number 10. She says, the bloody, murderous nature of Yehu's revolt and his religious zeal against the Omrides. I like that. Omrides or Omrides, the descendants of Omri. Right? His campaign to destroy the house of Achav and to destroy the worship of the Baal may have contributed to Ataliah's slaughter of the few remaining Davidites. There are three possible scenarios in which this may have been so. Ataliah might have been infected by the reformist zeal that motivated Yehu. It records, and I'm skipping a little bit, it records how Yehu went after the worshippers of the Baal. You know what? We don't know that Ataliah is ever a worshiper of the Baal. Maybe she is. Her sons certainly are. But maybe she's not. Maybe there is religious fervor. I thought that was a really interesting possible read. I don't know why, though, that would be done right now. At this point in history, that's when she's going to do it. And then the other two scenarios are simply fear that she proposes here in number 10. Fearing that the other members of the house of David are going to be attracted to Yehu's religious message and come after her. Or that Yehu is going to rally the people against her because she's from the family of Achav and Izebel. So she says, I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen. I'm wiping out the household. But here's my question, now that we're 25 minutes in. Is she a villain or is she a victim? Can you argue that she's a victim of her heritage, the curse on her family, the violence done to her parents, to her siblings, and to her son? We have cross-generational punishments in the Torah, and they're always problematic. The house of Eli has a curse on it that leads to the destruction of the city of Nov, city of the Kohanim. You have a ban on marrying an Ammoni or marrying a Moavi because of their ancestral wrongs. Is she a pawn or is she a victim? One being a victim, I should say. Or is she a villain? So I point you to source number 11, the last source on the sheet. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is bothered. Because I have one text in the Torah that says, parents shall not be put to death for their children. Lo yumtu avot al banim. And then on the other hand, we have this idea of, the way the Gemara phrases it is different. I should say it the way the Gemara does. The Gemara asks, why do I need a sentence to say parents will not be put to death for their children? Why do you need that when we're already taught each man will die for his own sins, ish bechat o yumat? And the Gemara goes through a discussion, and then it challenges and says, poked avon avot abanim, that Hashem, in fact, remembers the sins of parents for their children. So on the one hand, each person dies for their own sins, and then on the other hand, God visits the sins of the parents on the children. And the Gemara's answer is, it depends on the nature of the kids. It depends on what their relationship is with their parents and what their parents did wrong. If the parents' sin is echoed in the children, then God will say the punishment of the parent will also be brought for the children. Whether that's because we're saying that the descendants are somehow predisposed to certain behavior, which God says I want to eliminate, or whether it's the idea that they enter this world with a certain handicap that they can break with special merit, however you read this, the Gemara is trying to say that when descendants echo the actions of their ancestors, God says, I'm going to treat you the way that I should have treated your ancestors. I'm going to bring this upon you as well. Understanding that Gemara, I understand more now about what happens with Ataliah. Because that's what Ataliah did. she revisited that which the previous generations did. The bloodshed that was seen in Ahab's family before is echoed in her. The Baal worship that was seen before may be echoed in her. That is less clear. But it's certainly a legitimate read of the sentence that says the sons of wicked Atalia took the vessels for the Baal. In other words, she's not duped. She was not predestined. And I go back to what I said at the 9 a.m. shir. You can't read this from God's point of view because we're lacking information. You can't read it from the character's point of view because we're lacking information. But we read it from our perspective. I am a reader of the text and I'm looking at the information that I have sitting in front of me. I can't take the God position and label her as villain or victim or victor. That's not for me to say. But from what I read, what I'm seeing is somebody who emulated the generations before in all the wrong ways. They were bloody, Jezebel killing Naboth and so on, and killing the prophets of Hashem. She echoed that. They worshipped the Baal. She echoed that. She had a choice, like everybody does, to break the pattern of previous generations or to follow it. And she opted to follow it. And therefore, she meets this fate. But it doesn't have to be that way. The house of Eli does have an option of breaking out. The Talmud brings us numerous stories of people who said, I'm descendant of the house of Eli, but I don't follow what the house of Eli did. I engage in tzedakah. I engage in Torah, and therefore the curse is forestalled for them. The curse does not affect them. And the same thing is true here, because there's one more member of the family in this story. We focus a lot on Yehoash. He's the survivor. He becomes the next king. But who else survived from the family? The daughter, Yehosheva. Yehosheva, daughter of Yehoram, who's the one who saves the monarchy. Right? She is the one. She proves that it can be done. Atalia did not have to go this route. And Yehosheva proves it. So what we see here, I think, is a powerful lesson for us. Forget judging Atalia. That's not our business. But it's a lesson for us. One should never say, I have to be this way. My parents were this way. My grandparents were this way. You can make the choice that Yehosheva made and so escape whatever fate met Atalia. Thank you very much. We continue now with the 6:30 shir.